I want to get into a discussion of dark matter anomalies. These are not necessarily dark matter anomalies, obviously. Then we would know that we've discovered dark matter. But I'm going to tell you about all the things that people talk about as might be related to dark matter. And these things are very interesting, not just because they're possible signals, but because even if they're wrong, they've really all caused us to change the way we think about dark matter and to conceive of new theories. So if you think about the theories like the neutralino or the fourth generation neutrino or the axion, these things all came about because you had some other theoretical physics problem you wanted to solve, and it turned out there was a new stable particle that could get the right relative abundance in it, and so then you consider that as a candidate. But you can go the other way. You can have an anomaly, and then you can create a model out of that anomaly, and then you can see whether or not it fits into your existing structures or not. But the types of models that you get out of something which is inspired by data are often totally different from the ones that you just get by, you know, conceiving of them out of your mind. So, of course, interrupt me at any time. The first dark matter anomaly, these are in no particular order except for the order that I put them down in my notes, is the integral 511 keV anomaly. So the integral satellite has two instruments on it, SPI and IBIS. SPI has very good energy resolution. IBIS has very good angular resolution. So SPI looked at the gamma rays. These are X-ray telescopes. It's sort of studying in the MeV range, roughly. And what did they see? They saw an enormous peak right at 511 keV. And the spatial morphology, with three-year data, at any rate, was something like this, where these are contours of, you know, increasing flux. And what is this? So this is the, has everybody seen, people have seen galactic maps like this before, right? So you take the entire sky, you know, the galactic center is over there. I cut the sky down like this, then I unfold it, right? So if I want to turn this into the sky, I fold it and I paste it together. So this is the center of the galaxy. If that's the center of the galaxy pointing that way, then this point is pointing that way. This point is the same as that point. This point is the same as that point. Anyhow, the point is this is in the center of the galaxy. Okay, so they had a strong signal from the center of the galaxy, 511 keV radiation, a very sharp line. This is not a new particle, obviously. This is positrons capturing with electrons, forming positronium, and then annihilating into a gamma ray X-ray at 511 keV, which we then observe. So this is interesting not because there's a new particle, but because of two things. First of all, the number of positrons you need is about 3 times 10 to the 42 positrons per second, which is a very, very large number. It's comparable to the total production of positrons that you expect from all astrophysical sources in the entire galaxy. Remember, the entire galaxy stretches like this in this image. So this is an incredibly bright source, much brighter than all the rest of the galaxy. The second thing that's interesting about it is that its morphology, its spatial morphology, does not look like what you would have expected for basic astrophysical sources, right? If you think that these positrons are coming from something like supernova, then you can look at tracers of supernova formation like aluminum 26. And if you do that, then not surprisingly, you get something which, you know, approximately traces the disk of the galaxy. So the candidates that you have for ordinary positron production have one spatial distribution, and this has a different spatial distribution. It's very spherical. And so it makes you think, well, maybe, you know, dark matter, we expect to have a spike in the middle of the galaxy. There should be a lot of dark matter there. So maybe this is a reasonable, maybe dark matter could be producing this. So why is this not obviously WIMPs? Well, the rate, if you want to actually produce these positrons, the rate of positrons you get from dark matter, say, is 3 times 10 to the 42 positrons per second. If you have a cross-section, if you take a weak-scale particle of 500 GeV and you want to ask, what kind of cross-section do I need to get this many positrons? The cross-section you need is something like 2 times 10 to the minus 20 collisions per second, which is very, very large, right? Remember, the size of the cross-section that you need to get the thermal relic abundance correctly is 3 times 10 to the minus 26. So this is 6 orders of magnitude off from the cross-section that you believe that you should have, and that's a lot. Secondly, if partial wave unitarity for S-wave unitarity is only about a factor of 20 higher than this, right? So you're already getting very, very close to the upper bound of cross-sections that you might possibly have at all for these types of models. So it's difficult to get dark matter to do this. Next, if you actually look at this line shape, you can look at the width of this line, okay? And the width of the line tells you something about the properties of the particles when they're produced. If the particles are produced at very high energy, like 100 GeV, then they've got some probability that they will annihilate while still in motion, right? Because what you can do is if you annihilate while you're moving, instead of giving 511 keV, you'll get some line which is boosted one way or the other. So if you have a lot of in-flight annihilations, this line will get smeared out. And so the fact that it's very narrow can give you an upper bound on what the initial energy of those positrons was. And so just looking at the line shape tells you, and people will argue about this, exactly what the number is, but but it tells you that the injection energy is something less than a few MeV. And some people will tell you that a few MeV is 10 MeV, and some people will tell you it's 3 MeV. But that's not really the point here, right? The point here is that it's not, you know, tens or hundreds of GeV. So this is definitely, definitely not a weak scale particle annihilating into positrons and electrons that then turn into positronium, because the line shape would be totally different. So what can you do?
Again, so if I remember correctly, they have found that the distribution was asymmetric around the center and it was correlated with
the source. So yeah, I can get into that. So in the 5-year data, there was a slight asymmetry in this that they began. So you expect there to be a disk component as well. And they began to resolve the disk component in the 5-year data. And it was slightly asymmetric in one direction in longitude. And they noted that they have a catalog of low-mass X-ray binaries as well. And they said that if you look at the catalog of low-mass X-ray binaries, it seems to have a similar asymmetry. And so they said maybe low-mass X-ray binaries are the source for this. I can tell you two things about that. The first thing about that is that even within that paper, they were very, very cautious about whether or not this was the explanation. For instance, they said that even assuming that you take a very favorable assumption about the extrapolation of the low-mass X-ray binaries into the galactic center, you are still unable to account for actually the entire signal. And that's just the fact that, yes, you have an asymmetry, but you still don't have a lot of LMXDs in the galactic center. More recently, there's some work which has not been published yet, but I was just at this Rome conference, and Ubertini, who's the principal investigator of Integral, was commenting, and he made some oblique comment at the end of his talk. He said, oh, and by the way, we had this LMXB proposal, there are some issues with that they'll be publishing, that it doesn't seem to be working as well as that it initially was. But I won't go into that. I will let them publish their paper, and you can see. But at the very least, Ubertini still definitely believes that there is a big open question as to what this source is. At least that's the impression I got. So, what are the possibilities for this? Well, one possibility is that I can lower this cross-section significantly if I also lower the mass significantly, right? So, one way that I might think is that I'll just lower the mass such that I have an MeV dark matter candidate annihilating straight into E plus E minus. And this was studied by a lot of people. The models that most people talk about are by Bohm and Faye, but also Hooper, Silk, Pospelov, others have studied these kinds of scenarios. And the it looks like a very good idea, and I think it's a reasonable proposal. The difficulty that you run into with this is you need to still have a large cross-section for dark matter annihilating into E plus E minus, but you don't want to have E plus E minus have a very large coupling to the sector. So you need to introduce a fairly light MeV mass gauge boson, which mixes very, very weakly with the standard model, very, very weakly, but is very, very strongly coupled to the dark matter in order to get this kind of annihilation. It's a model building issue. It can be done. So this is one proposal. Another proposal, one that I'm fond of, is the exciting dark matter, or XDM proposal. In this, you take a weak scale candidate, but you imagine that your dark matter candidate has two states which are split from each other by about an MeV. So here's zero. And then you imagine that there's some process by which dark matter becomes excited, and then this excited state cruises along and eventually decays into E plus E minus when it goes back down to the ground state. This still requires this enormous cross-section. And so you need, in order to have a cross-section which nearly satisfies partial wave unitarity, the only way that you can actually do this is if you introduce a new force-carrying boson. So the dark matter sector, in this case, the dark matter sector has also a sub or approximately GeV force-carrying particle phi. So it's not as easy as just introducing dark matter with an excited state. You also have to introduce a new force carrier for the dark matter, which has a mass scale which is lighter than a GeV, because you need a very, very long-range force to have this kind of an excitation. If you look at that cross-section up there and convert it to natural units, the size is roughly 1 on GeV squared. So you can't have a mediator which is larger than that and still get an appreciable cross-section. And even then, you need to make sure that you don't have a barely chord profile. You need to use one of these iNASTO profiles. This limit here comes from the Aquarius simulation, but it's not trivial that you can just take any old halo profile and get this to work. Yes? How does unitarity tell me?
You said because of partial wave unitarity, you have to do this particle?
Partial wave unitarity tells that you need, partial wave unitarity tells you that you need to have a cross-section which is, that cross-section comes from what we need to actually get this. That's comparable to the partial wave unitarity. Really, the point about the size of the cross-section is just that if I want to have a cross-section of a given size, and this is GeV squared, the range of the force, right, just the range here that I can see, the effective cross-section, can't be any larger than the Compton wavelength of the particle because its potential becomes distorted at distances larger than that. So in distances inside of that, it's effectively massless. But you're still limited by partial wave unitarity there, that I can't just dial up couplings arbitrarily and get infinite cross-sections. I'm still limited by partial wave unitarity, even inside that range. So you're constrained in these kinds of models to get, you really need a very large cross-section that's forced upon you. One alternative that Andrew can tell you about is instead of this setup, if you have a situation like this, where you've got an MeV splitting here, and this splitting is something smaller than an MeV, say 100 keV, then you can kick up to the excited state and then fall back down if this is metastable. And in that case, it's much easier to get a large cross-section because the exchange momentum is smaller. So that's integral. And these are the types of, so basically, two types of models that I know of. There's also some decaying scenarios that I'm not going to go into. But the types of annihilating models that get this are either a very light dark matter or dark matter that kicks itself into an excited state. Yes?
Why that dark matter particles are composite objects, if you can be excited?
So having an excited state is, being composite is certainly one way to do that, and people have explored composite models. But another very, very easy way to do this is to imagine that there's an approximate symmetry on the system. So, for instance, you could model this in your mind as the neutron-proton mass difference, that they're related by an isospin symmetry, which is approximately broken, and so then those states get split from one another. So as a matter of course, because we're not very smart, it's much easier to work with perturbative models with small symmetry breakings than it is to work with composite models, which are strongly coupled, generally speaking. I mean, they don't have to be strongly coupled, but strongly coupled composite models tend to be the ones that work. So it's easier to calculate in the approximate symmetry models, but composite models are possible to talk about. Yeah.
I go to E and B over time.
In the light dark matter model, there is not supposed to be any symmetry. That the cross section for E plus E minus to chi chi would be related to the cross section for chi chi going to E plus E minus.
You don't want to see that.
Right, right. You don't.
So how do you?
So you need to be very, very careful with your tunings to get this with your parameters to get this to work. But Bohm and Fayette went through and studied this. Actually, the strongest constraints on this end up being from precision measurements of like G minus 2. And there is a window of parameter space which is open. But yes, this is precisely the sort of thing that you run into when you start introducing light particles that are available to accelerators. Okay. So that's integral. Next, you have egret. I should be clear when we talk about egret that there are actually three anomalies that people would talk about. So let me tell you what they are. The first one is the diffuse extragalactic signal. So I should say, egret is a gamma ray telescope looking in the sort of like 100 MeV up to tens of GeV range in gamma rays with moderate angular resolution. They're the precursor to the Fermi satellite, which is up now. So one thing that people talk about is that there's a diffuse extragalactic signal. So if I point perpendicular to the galaxy and I sort of look around, there's a very big background of gamma rays. This is not really a problem. It's not that somebody says, oh, where are those things coming from? There are expected to be astrophysical sources for the diffuse extragalactic signal. But some people still like to say, well, maybe it's coming from dark matter anyway. So I don't really think of this as a dark matter anomaly, but people talk about it, and so I'm telling you about it. The second one was the diffuse galactic signal. So don't look perpendicular to the plane. Look at stuff that's in the galaxy. And what was there was, if this is your flux, I think it's actually E squared times the flux. And then this is around a few GeV here. The expected background, so you use a program like Galprop to calculate what your expected gamma ray background is, which come from a variety of sources, inverse Compton scattering, production of pi zeros from cosmic rays colliding with the interstellar medium, things like that. And there was a very pronounced excess between the expectation from theory at around a few to up to about 10 GeV. And so you might get excited about this and say, well, this is coming from, say, 100 GeV particles annihilating into pions. Those pions then decay into gamma-gamma, and then I get some excess in this range. And a great deal was made about that. But then Fermi just released their data, and it looks like that. So it appears that there was some sort of problem with the egret instrument in this energy range, and so this excess is no longer an excess. But people have talked about it, and so you should know about it. Then there is the third egret excess. The third egret excess is very similar to the second one, but it's a galactic center. So that's inside 5 degrees of the galactic center. So if you look at there, again, you have something where it looks like this. The break happens at something about 10 GeV. The error bars out here are huge. It's not even clear that you should think of this as an excess at all. It's more of like a tendency to be going in the wrong direction. But it's still talked about that there's some discrepancy between egret and expectations in the galactic center. The galactic center is a very, very complicated region. But it's still very interesting for a reason I'll connect to in a second. Fermi has not released data on the galactic center yet. Hopefully, they will sometime soon. Questions about egret?
Fermi's been up less than a month, right?
No. Fermi's been up for like a year.
Oh. Right.
Yeah.
So how can dark matter just be in this axis?
Oh. the way that dark matter would explain this excess, one way would be if dark matter annihilates directly to something which then decays into gamma rays. But the way that most people talk about this or think about this, it would be that you actually have dark matter annihilating through some process that we won't describe into E plus E minus. Okay? And then you've got this high energy. You got this 100 GeV E minus coming through, and then you've got the interstellar radiation field that comes through, and you get a scattering off of that electron. And if you look at if you've not been reading your Klein-Nishina formula recently, the upscattering of these photons is roughly gamma. It goes like gamma squared. So the boost of the electron squared gives you the correction to the energy of the photon. So if you've got roughly 1 eV optical photons from various processes, you know, but starlight, things like that, you also have the infrared radiation field, then these can get upscattered into the multi-GeV, 100 GeV energy range when they collide. So these would be sort of secondary photons that would come because you produce high energy electrons and positrons that then upscatter your background photons into the appropriate energy range. So in some ways, you shouldn't think of this as a gamma ray excess. This is it could be a gamma ray excess, or it could be an indirect electron positron excess. Or it could be, I mean, we've known that EGRIT had problems before, so maybe this is just a problem with EGRIT. Other questions about that? Yes?
So you talked to number two, it looked like you said there was some range out that EGRIT had problems, and so there's an upper limit as well. Roughly how far does this excess extend?
This extends up to about 100 GeV, but this is sort of an after, about 100 GeV. 60 GeV. This excess is above where the diffuse galactic excess was. But its statistics are also much, much worse.
So where exactly is the window? Is that what you're saying? It's
10 GeV? Oh, no, it's about it's about 1 or 2 up to about 10 GeV.
Okay.
Is where the diffuse excess is. I decided to go with drawing on my here instead of pulling down the projector. I apologize. But I can send anybody who's interested the actual plots I have.
What about interactions with dark matter with CMBR photons?
They would also be there, but the CMBR photons are such lower energy that when they get upscattered into a lower energy range. So they're there, but they're just not at this highest energy range. That's actually interesting and relevant if you start looking at diffuse, if you start looking at extragalactic signals, then the CMB, because you have fewer sources in that energy range, you have a better chance of seeing. If you look at diffuse extragalactic signals from dark matter annihilation, then you have a chance of seeing the CMB inverse Compton scattered photons. So then you have the WMAP Hayes. This is a personal favorite of mine. This was discovered by Finkbeiner in 04, and then was studied again by Dobler and Finkbeiner in 08. I have to tell you just a very, very brief story about the WMAP Hayes, because it's a very, very difficult analysis to do, and if it weren't done by somebody very, very serious, then I would not believe it. But Doug Finkbeiner, who discovered this, is actually one of the most highly cited astronomers year after year, because he made the maps of dust, right? If you want to point your telescope somewhere and see something, you need to know what the dust extinction is. And so somebody had to make the maps of all of that dust, and that's what Doug did. So I bring this up because you have to be a very serious person to make dust maps, right? That's not like glamour, you know, crazy dark matter model building type of person. That's like, you know, dust. And when Doug discovered the haze, Doug was not out to, you know, find some new signal. He was embroiled in this huge, very vitriolic battle within the dust community as to whether dust just vibrated or dust also would spin. Okay? Because spinning dust has a different spectral distribution in the in its microwave emission than just vibrating dust, than just hot dust. And so people battle back and forth. And so Doug said, I will venture into uncharted territories. I will go into the WMAP data, and I will see whether or not we need to have a spinning dust component to explain the microwave foregrounds that are there, right? So if you look at the WMAP data, people always like to show it with the galactic centers subtracted out, but there's this huge, bright stuff in the middle, right, which is all of the microwave emission from the galaxy. And usually they just have a way of subtracting these foregrounds. So Doug said, I'm going to go, and I'm going to look at that. So what are the different sources of microwave backgrounds here? Well, you've got soft synchrotron radiation. So you've got electrons and positrons produced from, say, supernova remnants, things like that, that are then moving around in the galaxy and radiating in the galactic magnetic field. Those produce microwaves. You have, of course, you have the CMB, right? The CMB is, of course, microwave. You need to subtract that off. You have what astronomers will refer to as free-free, and particle physicists would refer to as bremsstrahlung. So you've got hot gas, particles scatter, they produce a microwave. And then, of course, you have dust and maybe spinning dust. So the thing about these signals is that if you actually look at the intensity as a function of frequency, so WMAP has five frequency bands in some intermediate range, you know, from 23 up to about 90 gigahertz. And the spectrum for soft synchrotron falls as a function of frequency. Dust and spinning dust both rise as a function of frequency. The free-free is fairly flat. But what you can do is you can go into the low-energy regime, into low-frequency regime, make a map of the galaxy at low frequency, say, aha, this is my map of soft synchrotron. Then you can go to high frequencies and say, OK, this is my map of dust. The free-free, you can't do that with, but it's associated with hot gas, which is associated with H-alpha emissions. So you can do H-alpha maps. So you can get H-alpha maps for this. And so that allows you to have templates for all of these things. And when you subtract all of those things off, allowing the spectrum to float within some reasonable range, Doug ended up with, so you have to black out the known really bright sources of the galaxy, right? Because some things are just too bright to study at all. And he was left with this haze that was approximately spherical, located in the galactic center. Initially, he thought it was some sort of additional bremsstrahlung, but it didn't correlate at all with any maps. And the excess that he sees in the lower two frequency bands correlates with the microwave excess in the higher frequency bands, so it appears to be that the excess is persistent through all of them, and it's the same spatial morphology in all of them. So the explanation then that was proposed was that this could be, what is this? This is going to, you're going to need some new sorts of microwave radiation. The easiest way to get some new hard, it's not just excess microwave radiation, it's excess hard microwave radiation, would be if there's some new source of E plus E minus, which are synchrotron radiating in the galactic magnetic field. And what's challenging about this anomaly is that all of your basic sources that you expect to be producing positrons are going to be correlated with the disk of the galaxy again, and this is something that's very spherical. So, for instance, you could imagine that, because people often talk about pulsars as a source of high-energy electrons and positrons, pulsars give a very poor spatial morphology because they don't have this intense clustering in the center of the galaxy that extends out of it like this. If you have something like that, then you expect something which would be much more uniformly distributed. So the possible explanation of this is very, very similar to the explanation for EGRIT, and is one of the reasons why I personally am excited about all these things. And that is that, again, you can have mystery annihilation of dark matter into E plus E minus, but there's actually two significant energy loss processes in the galaxy. One of them is this inverse Compton scattering, and then the second one of them is just synchrotron radiating in the galactic magnetic field, and the synchrotron radiation component of the energy loss then generates this haze. So the thing that kind of has begun making me more and more excited about all this positron electron stuff recently is that you start seeing different sources in different ranges all point to this idea that there might be some new anomalous source of E plus E minus production in the hundreds of GeV range. So that is the WMF haze. Yes?
So the reason that it's here is because this is where the galactic...
So this is where the galactic center is. And so if you look at... This is the unfortunate problem that we didn't do. If you look at actually the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy, and almost all models, there's some sort of rapidly increasing. So this is rho dark matter. And this is the radius, the galactocentric radius. And as you move in, it goes up significantly. So you can get increases in the galactic center of, because annihilations go like density squared, because you need two dark matter particles. You can get enhancements in the galactic center of order, 100,000, depending on how interior to the center of the galaxy it is, and how cuspy you think your model is, because maybe it does that. You know, it might not continue up indefinitely. It's on the south side because it's masked out on the north side. There's a relatively nearby supernova remnant called the Northern Galactic Spur, which just kind of like arcs across the sky, very bright microwave source. So this part here that I've masked out is just all known incredibly bright microwave sources. Yes? I think that it's been resolved that it's thin, but I only talked to Doug about this, so, I think yes. I think it does.
I have a question.
Yes.
So wouldn't these 100 GeV E plus E minus pairs also contribute to the width in the 511?
They would, but positrons of this energy range, so what happens to a positron in the galaxy? I wasn't really going to go into this because it seems a bit, it's not entirely orthogonal, but it's a bit orthogonal. So what happens to a positron or an electron that you emit in the galaxy? It's going to sort of cruise around the galaxy in a random walk. There's a turbulent magnetic field in the galaxy, and this electron or positron is going to be following the field lines and scattering off of the field lines and sort of random walking throughout the galaxy. And the size of the step size will vary as a function of energy. And as it's doing that, eventually it's going to continue to lose energy as it goes along. But eventually, the magnetic field of the galaxy doesn't extend out indefinitely, so eventually you're going to get to a point where you just probably free escape out of the galaxy and go off into infinity. So these positrons, for the most part, will diffuse well away from the galactic center before they even have a hope of getting to a low enough energy that they can capture and then annihilate. Okay? Because it's actually very, very, almost, when I said that the line shape would be modified, one thing I didn't say was that still, even though there is some contribution to in-flight annihilation, even then, your average positron actually stops before it annihilates. Some of them don't, but your average one does. So, really, for the most part, these things have to cool all the way down to nothing before they can capture. So you would have some contribution to the 511 keV line, but it's going to be very, 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 very spread out. Most of these things will probably escape the galaxy. And remember, the cross-sections that we're talking about here are something like, well, I haven't told you what the cross-sections are, but they're roughly around thermal cross-sections, so roughly around 10 to the minus 26. the cross sections we needed to be interesting for integral were like 10 to the 20, 10 to the minus 20. So in principle they can, but there are all these factors that work against it, so it ends up not contributing much. Yes?
Because finite people are looking at dark matter annihilation in away from the center of galaxies, because they think that it comes from microhalos, and that in the center of galaxies, microhalos are all destroyed by tidal gravity. So how come they look at the edge of the galaxy, and here it comes from the center of the galaxy?
You certainly can look at. I think that even people who look at the outer part of galaxies and talk about increases in flux because of microhalos will not tell you that on average the flux in the outer part of galaxies is going to be higher than in the center of the galaxies. But your backgrounds are significantly lower as you go out of the galaxy. So it's really a signal to background question. So if there are microhalos, then the outer part of the galaxy could be much more useful in a signal to background sense than the center of the galaxy where there are a lot of background sources. Or there's one other possibility that people talk about, which is that you can actually try to look for individual substructures and point at individual substructures. And that is also a possibility. And it just depends on what you think about the likely distribution of those structures is. I mean, this is a big battle as to how much substructure is there really in the galaxy. And if there's a lot, then it could be very useful for dark matter direct detection or dark matter indirect detection. If there's not, then it's less. I'm pointing at these things in particular because these are where there seem to be signals. If there were a glowing subhalo, then I would talk about that as well. Other questions? So yesterday we did Dhamma. So I won't do Dhamma today. So now let me get to what's been really causing the brouhaha over the last year. And most of that brouhaha comes from the Pamela satellite. Pamela is an Italian, Russian, Swedish collaboration, but since it's mostly identified with the Italian group at this moment, it's pronounced Pamela, and you have to gesture. And what do they see? Well, they look at the positron fraction. They look at the ratio of positrons to positrons plus electrons in the galaxy. They look at what they see locally, because you just wait for one of them to hit your satellite or your detector in your satellite. And they look at it in the sort of like 1 up to, at the present, about 100 GeV range. And there have been some indications before that maybe there was an excess from experiments like heat and AMS. So there's various old experiments. And so you have an expectation of what you think the positron fraction should do as a function of energy. Because keep in mind that the universe is made out of matter. It is not made out of antimatter. And so looking at antimatter sources is a good way to look for new things. Because, you know, then that's not just standard things making ordinary things go faster. It's something new actually making new things. And in particular, for these positrons, the way that you expect to get them is that you have a population of high-energy cosmic rays that we know, right, they're always hitting us from in the atmosphere and so on, which are propagating through the interstellar medium. And then those cosmic rays, high-energy protons, will smack into the interstellar medium, hit something in the interstellar medium, produce, say, pions, pi plus pi minus. Those pi plus pi minus will then decay and give you either immediately positrons, or will decay to muons, then give you positrons. So the point about that is that you don't a priori know anything about what your positron fraction should really be, but you do know what your protons, because you can just measure them, and you can measure your electrons. And the fact is that if you think that your positrons are coming from protons, that are interacting with the interstellar medium, then as you go to higher and higher and higher energies, you expect your positron fraction to get lower and lower and lower because there are fewer and fewer sources to actually produce those high-energy positrons. I'm lying a little bit, but I'm not effectively when I say this, but you expect something that goes like this. Now you expect something falling as a function of energy. You don't know whether it should be falling like this, or falling like this, or falling like this. You just expect something to be falling. And then what happened is that Pamela comes along, and they saw something that was rapidly rising up to about 0 point, depending on which data release you're talking about, 0.13 at the highest energy of about 100 GeV. Okay. And so then everybody got very excited because what this very, very strongly seems to be indicating is that there is some new primary source of positrons in the galaxy. I'm not saying it's dark matter at this moment. I'm just saying that there's something out there which is making a lot of high-energy positrons. At about the same time as this, there was the experiment Attic. It's a balloon-borne experiment. And they published results from about 20 GeV is actually more pronounced than this. And these error bars are bigger. That at about 700 GeV or so seemed to show a very big spike, a very big feature. And so everybody got very excited about this and said, look, this is some new source here going up. Here we've got some big spike. It's very exciting. More recently, there was the Fermi experiment. Fermi is a gamma experiment, but their dominant background are electrons. So they need to have very good electron identification to reject their background so they could do good gamma ray studies. As it turns out, now everybody is also interested in electrons. So they could also do a very similar study to this, and they find something that looks more like this. And then out here, there is some data from the Hess experiment, which look kind of like that. Hess is an atmospheric Cherenkov telescope. They can't distinguish photons from electrons, really, but they can at least put an upper bound on the flux of positrons. So this is what the sort of canonical fitting is nowadays, which seems to be in conflict with Attic. Attic has not given up. They say, look, we're a bigger experiment. We have better energy resolution, even if our statistics are worse. And Fermi, I think, would say, well, they can do a different study where they'll get better energy resolution. It's still in flux, but that's the status. But even so, most people who sort of like are in this business looked at this and said that this was an exciting result from Fermi, even though it did not have the big spike. As it turns out, it's very, very difficult to get dark matter models that give you a very, very sharp spike. The only ones that give you a very, very sharp spike are ones that annihilate directly into E plus E minus. So chi-chi goes to E plus E minus. That gives you a line, but then that line gets smeared out by the diffusion of positrons in the galaxy because they lose energy before they get to you. So most people, when they really, really tried as hard as they could to fit this peak, got something that, you know, looked more rounded and bumpy. So most people aren't that sad from their model point of view to deal with Fermi. But the reason why this is still exciting is that this signal here, this is E cubed dNdE of positrons and electrons. They cannot distinguish them. If you do previous measurements of electrons only, the electrons only seem to have a power law, which is something like e to the minus 3.2 at the sort of hardest to maybe e to the minus 3.3 on the softer side, but somewhere in that range. So you actually expect the true electrons to be just at e to the minus 3.2 or 3.3. So the fact that you have this difference here is then presumably coming about from this new source of positrons. You think, right? We don't know, but that's what you think. So the fact that there's a significant deviation from the expected slope and the fact that you see a new primary source here and the fact that you see a cutoff at high energies from Hess sort of all pieces together that whatever source it is that you're talking about should have a cutoff at around a TeV, and it should be very, very significantly predicting positrons. So I'm not going to talk about the pulsar explanation of this. Pulsars are something that people talk about. I'm not an expert on that. But certainly there is a very good astrophysical proposal, which are pulsars. Let me talk about the dark matter proposal. Why is this not obviously dark matter? There's basically three reasons that this is not obviously dark matter. The first thing is the size of the signal. If you want to explain this signal, in general, you need cross sections which are of the order of 3 times 10 to the minus 24 centimeters cubed per second. So if you want to have an annihilating dark matter do this, the cross section is about 2 orders of magnitude larger than the thermal cross section, which means that if it had this cross section in the early universe, it would be very, very depleted. And if it's very depleted, then there's no dark matter around today to annihilate and give you the signal. The second thing is that it's a spectrum into hard leptons, hard positrons. Most dark matter models have an annihilation, say, into things like we described before, into WW. Okay? That W boson will then decay into oftentimes quarks. More often than not, it will decay into quarks. And then those quarks will decay into pions. Those pions will then decay into positrons. So the signal you get is not some very nice high-energy signal. It's sort of a mushy, broad signal from hadronic annihilation channels. So you don't get something that's nicely rising like this. You usually get something that's kind of like this. It's just sort of a broad mush. And you can play with parameters and diffusion parameters and substructure in the galaxy and try to push that up, but you're fighting against sort of the natural tendency of the model. The third thing is Pamela also did a measurement of antiprotons. And when they did their measurement of antiprotons, they found no excess of antiprotons at all. If you look at standard dark matter models, which have these sorts of hadronic annihilation modes, you typically produce antiprotons, right? Because these quarks here will sometimes make antiprotons. On average, a W boson, a W minus, will make, on average, one antiproton every time it decays, roughly. And so if you normalize to this signal, then the contribution from antiprotons that you get, at least according to Donato and collaborators, is about anywhere from a factor of 10 to a factor of 40 too large. So the amount of antiprotons you get is well over an order of magnitude or more beyond what you see. And so there's a huge tension in trying to get a lot of positrons without getting too many antiprotons. So basically, these three things make it very difficult for any standard WIMP model to explain this. So what are the possibilities for dark matter models, anyway? The possibilities for dark matter models one possibility is that that dark matter decays. And there's a very, very good observation that was made by Yanagida and then also by Arvanitaki et al. That if you ask what kind of lifetime do I need for dark matter decaying to give me this signal, you need a lifetime of about 10 to the 27 seconds, right? So the universe is about 10 to the 17 seconds. This is much longer than the age of the universe. And you can just do a basic estimate of the decay of a TeV mass particle, which is decaying through, say, grand unified theory suppressed operators. So you just sort of do a dimensional analysis estimate of your lifetime. And if you do this, you get something which is very close to that. Okay, and of course there are pi's and g's and 2's that modify this, so it's an order of magnitude thing. But it's actually a very nice coincidence that if you sort of say, look, I've got some TeV mass particle, it decays through operators suppressed by the grand unified scale, then you naturally get the right lifetime. This doesn't explain necessarily why you're getting the leptons, and it doesn't explain why there's no antiprotons, but it deals with the size of the signal at the outset. You should be a little wary of this because any decent model builder, keep in mind there's a lot of mass scales in physics. You've got the gut scale, you've got the supersymmetry breaking scale, you've got the Planck scale, you've got the reduced Planck scale, you've got the axion decay constant scale, and then you get to multiply all those by a factor of a few, and you've got fourth and fifth powers here. So a decent model builder would have been able to come up to you and give you a fairly compelling story, irrespective of what this number was going to be on the right-hand side here. But still, I think this is better than that. This works better than just, well, I could have gotten it. It's a very interesting observation. So that's one possibility. Another possibility, well, before I get into the other possibilities, let me also comment that there are various constraints that you need to worry about. There are diffuse extragalactic constraints, which are more model dependent on what you think about distributions of halos. There are constraints from the galactic center. One constraint from the galactic center is that whatever process you have, if you have this kind of a process which makes positrons, then you necessarily have to have the ability to add an additional photon line here. So this is a final state radiation contribution. You also possibly, depending on your model, have situations where you can attach a photon to some internal light. That's not always. This, you always have, right? This is always there. And so if you do that, if you do these kinds of calculations, then you can relate a gamma ray signal from the galactic center to the presence of the positron signal that we observe here. And depending on, so now that you have the Fermi result, and not the, when you had the Attic result, there was, I think, a bit more tension with the galactic center. Now with the Fermi result, there is less tension, and it depends on which halo model you use. So NFW profiles have some trouble. Inasto profiles can be okay. Chord isothermal profiles are fine, but there certainly are constraints. The only problem with looking at the galactic center for constraints is that you're looking in the most constraining thing comes from the galactic ridge, which is 0.3 degrees plus and minus, and plus and minus 0.8 degrees. So you're really looking at the very center of the galaxy. So you're getting somewhat uncertain because you just don't know really what the halo does. So what you really have to make a statement of is, if the halo does X, then I have this kind of constraint. And I mean, you've heard me say this about factors of two in these limits before. I always think of these sort of constraint plots as, you know, just measurements of how uncomfortable I should be in thinking about models. And if the lines kind of like are right on top of it, then, you know, I'm not that uncomfortable. If the lines are an order of magnitude below it, then I'm a little uncomfortable. If they're two orders of magnitude, then I'm very uncomfortable. But there's enough uncertainties in here that I think that most people would still agree that these models are alive, and you can tell that based just upon the paper production. So let me, in the last few minutes here, then just tell you what is sort of this scenario that a lot of people are thinking about. Many people have been working on these sorts of things. Maxime Pospilov, who's here, has spent a lot of time thinking about this. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. So, at least the reason why I got excited about this and I started thinking about this is, if you remember back to the exciting dark matter model, the exciting dark matter model has this new force carrier. And so if you have a new force carrier, then you have the ability to have a new annihilation mode, right? You can have, instead of dark matter annihilating into, you know, E plus E minus or WW, you can have dark matter annihilating into phi phi. Whatever phi is this force carrier, whatever it is. But at least in the XEM setup, phi had to be lighter than a GEV. Right? It had to be lighter than a GEV just to get things to work. So that's why at least we were thinking about these sorts of models with things which were lighter than a GEV. So if it's lighter than a GEV, that strongly limits actually what you can decay into. You can't decay into antiprotons, for instance. And depending on your model, what often happens is that you end up decaying into either E plus E minus or mu plus mu minus or pi plus pi minus. At higher masses, you can start getting kaons, but K kaons already have a massive, two kaons already have a massive almost a GeV. So you're pretty much limited to decay modes that look like this. So the scenario is dark matter annihilates into two light bosons. These things cruise along and then decay later into one of these things, which then give you the positron signal. What's cool about this is that this automatically, did I erase it? This automatically solves these two problems for you, right? Why are you getting hard leptons? You're getting hard leptons because you're annihilating into a particle which is a GeV, so it's very boosted. Dark matter itself remains to be a TeV, right? So dark matter is very heavy, but it's annihilating something light, so you've got a particle which is very boosted that then decays into leptons. So you get boosted leptons, which means you get very hard leptons. You also don't get any antiprotons because kinematically you just can't get antiprotons. But we haven't discussed this question about why is the cross-section large, and that's sort of the last and nice ingredient in these stories. Just in case you didn't get to that chapter of Landau and Lipschitz, let me tell you about it. And this is the Sommerfeld enhancement. And the Sommerfeld enhancement is a very, very simple idea. And it was first pointed out that it could happen in the context of dark matter models by Hisano, Nojiri, and Matsumoto, in the context of very heavy Wino or Higgsino type models, where the role of this phi particle is actually played by W and Z bosons. And it's kind of like gotten very, and then was studied also by Chiarelli and Strumia, and now it's gotten a lot of attention in this kind of a setup. And so the idea is very simple. We can phrase it two ways. One is, imagine that you throw a rock at the sun at the speed of light. If you throw a rock at the sun at the speed of light, then the cross-section that you have is just pi r squared, right? It's just the rock will go straight, and you'll have that cross-section. But if you throw it significantly lower than the speed of light, then it will have a larger cross-section because it will be there'll be a focusing effect where particles get pulled onto the sun, and you have a correction that looks like this. So you have a cross-section which gets larger and larger as you go to lower and lower velocities, in precisely this way. This is exactly the Sommerfeld effect. This is the classical analogy of the Sommerfeld effect. What's really happening is that if you ever do a scattering calculation, if you want to calculate the process of two dark matter particles annihilating, if any scattering process, E plus E minus, doesn't matter, what do? You start with a plane wave approximation, right? And then you have those particles go together. You assume there's a single contact point of interaction, and then those particles fly out in asymptotic states. So this is the Born approximation. You're assuming that the incoming wave is undistorted by the presence of a potential. But if you have a long-range force, so if you've got some new particle which has a mass of a GeV or less, then you've got some effectively long-range force in your theory, and that tells you that the wave functions of the incoming states can be significantly deformed in the vicinity of the contact point where the actual interaction happens. So you can actually get a much larger wave function at that point, and a larger wave function at that point means a larger cross-section. I won't go into the analysis of it. It's a quantum mechanics problem. You can look it up all over the place. One way to think about this is that what you're doing is you're essentially, usually you imagine that your cross-section is just this. But what's happening here is that you need to sum up an infinite ladder of diagrams of exchanges of this intermediate particle before you get to this point. And all these exchanges pull you together more and more and more so that when you finally annihilate, you have a stronger amplitude to do so. So what's very cool is that if you have this kind of a setup, so you're annihilating into a light force carrier, then you automatically get this enhancement, and so you get the size of signal comes out for free. So that's, I think, one of the reasons that these sorts of things are very exciting. So let me make one final comment, because we're out of time, but let me make one final comment. All of these things that I'm talking about, of course, all could have nothing to do with dark matter at all today, right? It's certainly possible and you know, one could argue maybe probable. Just, you know, from a Murphy's Law perspective, how could we get so lucky that all these things are so interesting? But on the other hand, if any of these things are right, then it's telling us that all of our preconceived notions about dark matter are totally, totally wrong, right? Everything that we thought was natural about dark matter is totally not natural. If you're getting, you know, low-energy positrons or high-energy positrons or all sorts of things, then this is telling us that the very, very minimal assumptions that we always like to make about dark matter are wrong. And there was this observation that was made by Max Tegmark first that I'll rephrase slightly in a more colloquial way, but it's that you have to imagine that you are somebody made out of dark matter, right? Start by just imagining that you're a person and you're made out of dark matter. You go out and you do a CMB experiment with the neutrinos, right? And you study the distribution of the cosmic background neutrinos. And you are very careful and you discover that 4% of the universe is actually made out of something else, right? Something exotic that's not dark matter. And so one of your friends comes along and says, I've got a great theory for you to explain that 4% of the universe. Okay, are you ready? I'm going to start with three generations. I'm going to have three gauge groups of SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. I'm going to confine the SU3 to make composite objects. I'm going to break the SU2 cross U1 at roughly the same scale so that I only have this U1 left over. I'll make atoms out of that. I'm going to add CP violation for no good reason. And that's my theory of this 4% of the universe, right? And then all of your dark matter friends come up to you and they say, you are crazy. This is not this 4%. This 4% is, you know, it's like one particle, you know, with one force carrier, and that's it. You know, why are you being... And so the only point that I would like you to sort of like, if you forget about all the details to take away from this, is that we have this very, you know, people are like, oh, dark matter doesn't do this. Oh, we have this minimality assumption always in dark matter. But everything that we've actually ever seen in the universe is very, very, very far from minimal. So, probably maybe all this stuff might have nothing to do with anything. Maybe it does have something to do with anything. But I think the thing to take home is, you know, it's very good to keep an open mind about this stuff. We really don't know anything about what dark matter should look like at the end of the day. And, you know, we're just beginning to scratch the surface. So I'll stop and let you go on to the next thing. Thank you, sir.